This is a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. As we say goodbye to 2022, we wanted to take some time to revisit a really gratifying milestone that we got to help WBUR celebrate this year. Cognoscenti, WBUR's ideas and opinions page, turned 10. That's right, 10 years of thoughtful reflections, emotional insights, and moments of heartbreaking tragedy, and pure unbridled joy. And so many truly wonderful voices added to the WBUR family. So we wanted to close this year out by bringing you a few of our favorites. And first up, author John Vercher.
I used to make fun of my pop's afro. I remember the way he trimmed it in the bathroom mirror, the way he styled and shaped it to geometric perfection. I didn't know it at the time, but I envied that hair. I still do.
That's Vercher reading his 2017 Cognoscenti piece, The Unbearable Whiteness of Being. Vercher's latest book is After the Lights Go Out. And when he joined us in studio back in November, I asked him to start by telling us about his dad, a central figure in his Cognoscenti piece.
Oh, my dad's, he's an interesting guy. We have sort of that typical strained but not strained father-son relationship. We're not the huggers. We don't overly emote, but there's this sort of unspoken bond between us. And a lot of that has to do with how he raised me very early on to be aware and proud of my blackness, having conversations with me about that when I was as early as 7 years old.
In your piece, you start with your dad, but just as you did just here, it's kind of an entree into an exploration for you of your identity, the identity he taught you, the identity you're thinking about teaching your own kids. Talk about that identity some.
It's hard to talk about because it's something I'm still figuring out, honestly, even at 47 years of age. I actually think that I've spent maybe the last 10 years exploring it more than I ever did as a younger man. And a big part of that is having children now. I'm the product of a mixed-race relationship, and I'm in a mixed-race relationship, and so I have to think in even more different ways about how do I raise my sons in the culture to be proud of their culture when they don't outwardly reflect the culture. So it's been something that I explore through my own writing and explore through conversations with family. And I think it's kind of a never-ending conversation.
When you wrote this piece in 2017, we were partway through an emerging American experience confronting our racial history. Partway through, but certainly not at that 2020 mark,
right,
when it feels like things erupted in a whole new way.
Right.
When you look at that piece now and you're hearing it again, and, you know, when we did the 10th anniversary celebration at City Space, you were there, I were there, I was there, you read it out loud. Does it feel like past or does it feel like present? Would you write it the same way now?
No, I don't know that I'd write it the same way. Part of that is just being a writer and looking back on old work and going, oh, that's terrible. I could have done so much better.
But it was good.
Well, thank you. But I think over the last few years, as I learn more about myself and about my own history and the history of black culture and speaking more with my father, especially when 2020 erupted the way that it did, I think I've added more nuance to the ideas of identity and have a different understanding of it. So does it feel old? It feels maybe slightly dated, but in very minor ways.
What does it mean to you to be biracial, to be multiracial?
I have no idea. I'm still figuring that out, honestly. It's because it's, in some ways, it is its own identity. But there is also this struggle, both internal and external at times, to choose a path and walk down that path. So, and it feels like no answer is the right answer. So I can't honestly answer that question because I think I'm still trying to figure that out.
Do you think you ever will?
I don't know.
Do you want to?
I don't know that either. I think part of the problem that one of the many problems that we deal with when it comes to this is that we're always looking to define things. We're always looking to make things so binary, right? It has to either be this or that. And I think if you figure it out, you're sort of playing into that system. And so it's far more interesting to me to explore it and ask questions about what it means than to firmly define what it means.
So I do want to talk about your voice for just a minute in that in the piece you talk about the conscientious way, for example, that you and your wife curated books, children's books, you know, by people of color, about people of color. You wrote a really fascinating piece about black characters in comic books and Marvel stories. And this was, I can't remember if it was right before the first Black Panther movie came out.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. So what do you want your boys to know and believe about their identity, given that you don't want to buy into these strict binary kinds of categories?
I think the thing that stands out most for me, and it was a lesson that I had to learn not that long ago either, was that when I want them to celebrate their culture and want them to know who their grandfather is, who I am, that it doesn't just have to be about trauma, that it can be about the celebration of black culture. It can be about all the successes and all the things that we've accomplished, not just the things we've suffered. Even as a young adult, I used to think that had to be the way that I define my blackness, that if I suffered enough, if I had gone through the things that my father had gone through, then maybe I was black enough. And it took an interview with another black woman who said, you know, why do you focus so much on the trauma? And I couldn't answer the question. It hit me like a shot to the gut. I was like, you're absolutely right. So I think that's the big thing, you know, behind that piece about not being sidekicks or you know, comic book characters, black comic book characters not being sidekicks. I want them to know that their culture isn't just about trauma. It's about celebrating successes.
Are we getting better at that?
We as in me?
No. We as in the American culture and
community. No, I don't. I think there's more. I think there's an increased consciousness about it, but I don't know that we're getting any better at it.
So you were talking about no longer wanting to focus or center trauma, right? And as you were thinking that, I was thinking, I want to talk to him about choosing to be an MMA fighter. And then you actually referred to being called out for that or asked about that as a blow to the gut, which you know what that feels like.
Yeah.
So it is a little ironic to have a guy who says, I don't want to focus on trauma, then say, but the next thing I went to and did, in addition to being a writer, which, as I understand it, you became after starting to work on Cognoscenti pieces.
Correct, yeah.
You decided to go be an MMA fighter.
Well, so I always give the disclaimer that I was sort of a tourist in MMA fighting. I trained in it and got the bug and wanted to compete, mostly to prove some things to myself. I certainly appreciate the irony, but it comes from a long history of martial arts for me. I started as a kid. I was, I watched Kung Fu Theater every Saturday, and then I was in the Taekwondo schools the minute the Karate Kid came out. But I discovered through talking about this most recent book that I wrote about MMA that the reason I loved martial arts so much is because as a mixed-race kid who was trying to navigate and find who he was, I didn't have to think about that on the mat. Like, that was never a thought. That place felt like an escape for me. And then I just happened to be kind of not terrible at it. And so it was, not only was it enjoyable, but it was just sort of this one place where I could kind of let my mind go free.
So we're speaking with John Vercher. His most recent book is After the Lights Go Out, which is about an MMA fighter whose lights are kind of starting to go out a little bit. And this is the last of our series speaking with WBUR Cognoscenti contributors in the 10th anniversary. You talk about it as an enjoyable experience. A lot of people spend their whole lives trying not to get hit. In fact, I think most people do, and most parents try to tell their kids not to get hit.
Yeah.
So where is the joy? I really do want to understand the joy in that, because I guess I can imagine that sense of knowing what you can take.
Yeah.
And feeling power.
Yeah.
Is that what it is?
That was a big part of it. I wrote an essay many years ago, sort of comparing my journey mostly through high school, because that's where I think I felt that identity struggle the most. And being in that first and only MMA fight that I did as an amateur, there were a lot of parallels to that, because I felt in a lot of ways not physically defenseless, but sort of mentally defenseless as a kid in high school, trying again to find where I belong, to try and find that path. And stepping into the cage or the ring, it's empowering. Like, it's terrifying. I mean, when you talk about not wanting to get hit, yeah, it's probably to this day the scariest thing I've ever done. But there is this sense that, okay, this is something I can do. I'm going to be able to walk out of here, hold my head high no matter what the outcome. Shows me that I can, as you said, I can take it.
How'd your dad feel about it?
He thought it was pretty cool. Yeah, he was. He didn't make that fight. Neither of my parents made that fight. It was pretty far away, but they were there for one of my kickboxing fights, one that I lost. And the support that I got from him, that quiet sort of just head nod and understand that I had made the effort, was pretty amazing.
And did that turn out to be important to you?
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure.
How come?
Sports was one of the ways my dad and I connected. He's one of these guys that had all those old VHS tapes of NFL's greatest running backs, and you know, boxing was part of the DNA of our house. I watched all the Hagler and Leonard fights and Ali and all that kind of stuff. So while we didn't always connect on everything, sports was that one thing. So to have him there for that was pretty amazing.
And do you connect with your kids on that?
Trying to, yeah. My kids, unfortunately, they've followed more of my other habits with video games. So it's, you know, they've recently taken to basketball, but it's always a struggle to pull them away from that iPad. But I can't. It's hard for me to criticize because I play video games myself. So
I want to talk about writing now, because sure. You've really painted for us here, John, a really interesting picture of your arc. This is a self-discovery arc. Mm-hmm. This is a wrestling with who you were and weren't as a kid, what you did and didn't want to be as a kid, and this journey of discovery. Where does writing fit in all of this for you? The first time you wrote a piece and submitted it to Cognoscenti, mm-hmm. like, how did you even get there?
Ironically, from another Cognoscenti writer, Ted Flanagan, who was at the 10th anniversary celebration with us. He and I attended the same MFA program, and we were looking to submit writing for publication, to see, you know, just to, as part of exercising our craft. And he mentioned that he had gotten a piece with this thoughts and opinion page, and it's still one of my favorite things that he's ever written. It's
is
so
good. Is this the one
so
about
great.
The boys that went to the World Series
yes.
tournament and lost every game and still
so
won?
So great. So great. And getting to hear him read it again was such a cool experience. But he thought some of the personal essay writing I had done would be a fit here. And, you know, we were both trying to sell our book, and I submitted a piece, ironically, about my son, and kind of took off from there.
So that book, Three Fifths, published in 2019, was called one of the best books of the year by the Chicago Tribune. You had a lot of success with that first book.
Yeah.
What do you love about this book, After the Lights Go Out?
It felt... It let me know that I could do it again, honestly. I was lucky enough that my first book was the thesis that I wrote for my MFA. So there was a lot of discipline involved in that, right? I had excerpts that were due to my mentors every so often. So I had to sit down and write. This second book, there was no guarantee I was going to sell a second book, and I didn't have to have parts of it turned in to anybody to review. So one of the favorite things about that, or one of my favorite things about that book, is just that I wrote it and that I was able to sell another one, to be honest with you. But it's also about so many things that are important to me. It's about race. It's about family. MMA is really just the environment that the characters live in. So getting to write about the things that I love is always, I feel very fortunate to do it.
On your journey, What's the best of who you are right now?
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
So what do you feel best about who you are right now?
I think that I'm being the father that I'd hoped I would be, that I'm being the writing professional that I'd hoped I would be, and that I'm being the husband that I hoped I would be. That those are all, that sounds really cliche and corny, but we're kind of a cliche and corny family. Like we're kind of sappy and, you know, that's how we are. And so to be successful in all those things is a pretty incredible feeling.
John Vircher is an author. His latest book, After the Lights Go Out. He joined us in November to talk about his 2017 Cognoscenti essay, The Unbearable Whiteness of Being. Stay with us. Coming up, Wellesley Professor Kelly Carter Jackson shares a powerful piece of her family's history with us. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. You're listening to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
I have a picture of my grandmother, Ethel Phillips, posing with the great-granddaughter of her employer. The picture was taken in the early 1990s. The child is looking up at my grandmother as she smiles into the camera. They are both holding small American flags. My grandmother is wearing a light blue dress. Actually, it was her uniform.
That is Wellesley Professor Kelly Carter Jackson reading from an essay she wrote for Cognoscenti, WBUR's Ideas and Opinions page. And all this hour, we are revisiting our favorite conversations from the 10th anniversary celebration of WBUR's Cognoscenti. Jackson's piece was as good as it gets. With so much to cover, we jumped right in, and I asked her to tell us about her favorite memory of her grandmother.
Oh, that's hard. I have so many. But she made two recipes that I feel like I can still taste in my mouth. One was zucchini bread. I absolutely loved it. And the second was a yellow cake with chocolate frosting. And it was, it would be all eaten in like 1 hour. It would be gone. But yeah, that was, and probably she used to let me do like beauty shop with her, and she let me brush her hair a lot. And I loved brushing her hair.
There's like 10 places I want to go just from that. You're bringing back memories of my own Nona. You're making me think of a segment we did in 2019 with El Simone Scott, where she talked about what she loved about the baking of her grandmother and great-grandmother. There is this intimacy of feeding and nurturing and touch and that our grandmothers bring to us. Is that why you wanted to bring Ethel Phillips' story to all the Cog readers?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I realized that so much about my grandmother's story represents all of the unseen and undervalued labor that that domestic workers experience in this country. You know, so much of what they do is undervalued or underappreciated, and not seen for their full humanity. I mean, it's so funny how so many people came up to me and told me similar stories and told me how a lot of people that their family members worked for didn't know their last names either, or didn't know their real names. Sometimes they often had like pseudonyms that they worked under. And so it was just a really powerful way to connect with other people, having this story that was so unique to me, but so universal for so many others.
So I want to hit a couple of facts here, Kelly, and then I'll give you a question. Ethel Phillips worked as a domestic worker for 59 years. When you and Cog first published the essay, you made a conscious choice not to reveal the identity of the family. But you did talk in the essay about, you know, for example, she was Mrs. Phillips everywhere else, but in she was Ethel. You've talked about the fact that she went in through the garage, not the front door, even though the family that employed her referred to her as family. Some members didn't even know her last name after she was done working there. I'm holding all of that, Kelly, and I'm thinking about the fact that it was the chocolate cake, it was the combing hair, it was the, you know, zucchini bread, and she was, as a domestic worker, providing some of those same things to people who you felt saw it as a commodity. And that is deeply dissonant.
You know, I still have a hard time reckoning with these relationships, because they are so complex. There's no simple good, bad binary. You know, on my grandmother's piano, there were pictures of the family members of the people that she worked for and pictures of their grandchildren alongside pictures of her own grandchildren. And so I always resented that a little bit, if I'm being honest. I was like, I'm her granddaughter. But it was because my grandmother was so loving. She really was. And so everyone who came into her home got fed. Everyone who was around her, she really embraced. And so, but these feelings are really, really difficult because, you know, the time that my grandmother spent working was time away from her own children, time away from her own family, meaningful and significant time away from her family. And I think there's a lot of, you know, conflicted feelings about how we make sense of that work and how we make sense of those relationships, because I don't doubt that the family she worked for loved her. I don't doubt that they had real affection for her. But I also have to be honest about the fact that this entire relationship is built under almost a caste system, a hierarchy system of servitude, and that there are real cultural practices about how domestic workers, particularly in the 50s, 60s, 70s, how they were supposed to work. And you never went through the front door. You always went through the back. You know, my grandmother never used a mop. She scrubbed floors on her hands and knees. She thought that was the best way to clean a floor. And as a result of that, her knees were always stained with black calluses. She was a fair-skinned woman, but her knees were like jet black. And I think about sort of the stains of her servitude, and it just, you know, it's very hard to reconcile.
We're speaking about Ethel Phillips, who is Kelly Carter Jackson's grandmother. Kelly is a professor at Wellesley College and a Cognoscenti contributor, and is part of the 10th anniversary of Cognoscenti. We're talking with some contributors. They re-upped your essay, Kelly, originally from 2019. There were a number of themes that came forward. You are no stranger to being able to embrace and articulate complexity. And one piece that's in there as well is not only this difficult dynamic of the relationship with the family and with your family, but also the fact that Ethel worked for Ethel Phillips. I want to call her Ms. Phillips, Mrs. Phillips, because that's what she was called everywhere else. That Mrs. Phillips worked for 59 years and did not have, into her 70s, as I understand it, and didn't have financial.
79, almost 80. Yeah.
Which just makes me exhausted to think about, by the way.
I know.
And didn't have financial security when she was done, Kelly.
Yeah. Oh, that is, I mean, this is part of, if we think of FDR's New Deal, part of that program really marginalized two groups of people, migrant workers and domestic workers. And, you know, 95% of these positions were held by African-Americans. And this is intentional, right? The South basically said to FDR, you will not get any of this New Deal legislation passed unless you keep out this group of people. So African-Americans weren't able to generate wealth. They weren't able to have protections for their job or pensions or these sort of unemployment benefits of retirement that you think of when you think of a traditionally good job. And when you think of a job that you work for your whole life, for three generations of the same family, most of us don't work like 3 years at the same company. So like to work for that long. And most people, you know, retire in their 60s, 65. This is, you know, working until almost 80 because there were no protections. That to me is just, it's just a lot. And, you know, my grandmother also had, you know, really bad rheumatoid arthritis. So her fingers, you know, would curve and bend alongside her arthritis. And so cleaning work is very labor intensive. If you've ever had to, like, you know, I know a lot of people don't know about this because in the pandemic we saw all of this laid bare, but like domestic labor is really hard, intensive labor, cleaning houses, cleaning toilets, making beds, dusting, all of that, taking care of children as well. And my grandmother took care of children too. It's a lot of work and you leave home exhausted. And I think the extra level of disrespect is that there's nothing wrong with that work. Like being a domestic worker, if that job is well compensated and that's a job that allows you to provide for your family, I don't think there's anything wrong with that job. But it's what's built into the system that perpetuates subordination, that perpetuates the servitude, And I'm also someone who's, you know, in the African-American culture, you don't refer to adults by their first name. You absolutely, it's either auntie or uncle or Mrs. or Mr. And so the fact that there are children, you know, toddlers calling my grandmother Ethel was just like so disrespectful to me. And even if they weren't intending it, I think all of us are familiar with titles and how you refer to elderly people or senior citizens, with ma'am or sir. There are ways that you can connote your deference for their age or for their position. And she never got that.
Kelly, we're speaking with Kelly Carter-Jackson, Wellesley professor, Cognoscenti contributor, about an essay being re-upped in celebration of Cognoscenti's 10th anniversary about your grandmother, Mrs. Ethel Phillips. Did she ever express to you awareness or frustration on the many complex fronts you've just laid out for us and that you touch on in your essay?
Not to me as much, because I was a child. And when I really came into understanding to want to write this, my grandmother had Alzheimer's, so I couldn't speak to her in a way that would have been cognizant. But my mother and
I'm
my
sorry,
aunt,
but just,
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, it's hard. It's also, when I wrote this essay, my son was born, my first child was born. And 6 days after that, my grandmother passed away at the age of 95. And so there was a lot that I was trying to process. I was trying to process being a new mom for the first time. I was trying to process her loss, her passing. And then at the time, my colleague asked me if I would write this essay, and I was hesitant. I was like, oh, I don't really, I'm so tender. I don't want to go into family history. But it was really, really good for me because I got to talk to my mom and I got to interview my aunts and my great aunts. My great aunt is 97 years old now. And so, and still in her right mind, to be fair. And she gave me, I interviewed her several years ago when she was about 93, but she gave me so much insight and so much material and fodder. And I even got to interview members of, you know, the family that she worked for. And I was kind of shocked at how forthcoming they were about their experiences with her. And so it was a lot of interviews, a lot of, you know, research trying to gather and make up different pieces. And in some ways it was really powerful because I was like, huh, this is a side of my grandmother I never got to see before. And I didn't realize as a child that when I saw her in those blue dresses or purple dresses, that they were uniforms. You know, I always thought, oh, this is just how she dresses. And my mom was like, no, it's not, those are rags. Like, this is what she wore when she was working. These were not, you know, beautiful dresses that you would wear to church or something like that. This was a part of a uniform. But as a child, you know, you don't have that that context or that information. But as an adult, you know, I see it so clearly now. I see it in plain sight.
You wear such a different uniform. You've got a cap and gown. You're a tenured professor. You're not just a tenured professor. You're a tenured professor with a named professorship. And for people who don't know how fancy that is, that's the pinnacle of fancy. How does that feel with that family legacy?
Oh, man. I feel like I am my ancestors' wildest dreams. I really feel like that. And I know maybe even saying that sounds cliche, but it is so real. I think about the fact that, you know, my grandmother never got a chance to go to high school, even though she was brilliant. She was valedictorian of her eighth grade. She was one of 16 children. She grew up in Mississippi. You know, she is the granddaughter of enslaved people. To think that these generations are not far removed from us. And to know that, you know, I'm not the first PhD. My mother is a retired professor. She has her PhD. I have my PhD. My nephew is currently working on his PhD. So there will be three generations of scholars in my family and perhaps more to come. It's such an answer to prayer. I don't think she could have imagined any of this.
That's Wellesley Professor Kelly Carter-Jackson. She joined us in November. Stay with us. Coming up, a local mom rock band makes it big. It's a fun one and you don't want to miss it. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering.
Does it matter to no one? Ring around the rosy.
And that is the Lazy Susans, the Milton-based mom rock band that rocketed to a sort of stardom after playing together at the Milton Porch Fest just over a year ago. All this hour, we have been revisiting conversations from our celebration of the 10th anniversary of Cognoscenti, WBUR's Ideas and Opinions page. And Joanna Weiss has been a longtime contributor to Cognoscenti on a wide range of topics. But it was her experience singing and playing with her band, the Lazy Susans, that Weiss decided to highlight as part of the 10th anniversary celebration. We sat down with her and two of her four bandmates, Layla Mitchell and Heather Shaw. Imge Zerinoglu and Martha Kennedy, also band members, couldn't make it that day. When Layla, Heather, and Joanna joined us in Studio 2, Layla started by explaining how they came up with the name, the Lazy Susans.
So I think we were kind of sitting around at the kitchen table one evening like we do, like we really have for the last 20 years with our kids running around. And a lot of times the dad's either on the barbecue or out in the backyard. And we kind of just said, hey, we should start a band. We should get together and do this for ourselves. And then, you know, assigning who's playing what, which was a little difficult because 3 out of 5 of us have never really had any musical background or any training. And so it came down to the shared experience that we were all going to kind of take part in lots of different things, and you know, we were going to rotate. And I said, well, why don't we be the Lazy Susans, like that thing that kind of goes around and moves around. And so that's where the name came from.
So how long have you been playing?
Well, it depends on who you ask, you know, because we have different amounts of musical experience. I took piano lessons as a kid and maybe like a millisecond of guitar lessons in my 20s and then kind of put it down, you know, to raise a family and to do work and to do all the things that life takes up. And then the pandemic happened, and that kind of thing in the back of your mind where you're like, oh, wouldn't it be fun to do that? My husband's doing that. That's great. My kid's doing that. That's cool. But you never have time and you never think that you should be the one doing it. And all of a sudden it was like, well, why wouldn't we do it? This kind of time and space opened up. And, you know, made me pick up a guitar and get a lot more serious about it.
So hit a strum on the guitar.
Okay, you just heard a little bit, but
yeah,
that's a G. Actually, it's not. That's an A.
So, Heather, how about you? You play bass and vocals. So you had gotten a bass for Christmas, mm-hmm. but never picked it up. But this makes me think you must have been talking about something, because on the pantheon of random Christmas presents from your spouse, an electric bass doesn't usually make the short list.
I know. Well, it's funny. I dated a lot of bassists in college. And so I'm like, maybe I'll play the bass someday. I've watched a lot of people play the bass. So I said to my husband, you know, maybe a bass for Christmas is a good starter instrument for me. I had never played anything before. And he did. He got me a used bass guitar for Christmas that year. And then the pandemic hit and it just sat hanging in my office and it looked really pretty. And I hadn't really picked it up. So, you know, when we were all sitting around the table, I'm like, well, you know, I own a bass and Joanna, you play guitar and MG plays just about everything. I'm like, let's start a band.
You're 3/5 of the way there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. And you brought in a tambourine today?
Yes.
And give it a shake. Let's hear it. All right. So, Layla, my understanding from, you know, my prep for this is that you were a little grumpier about this prospect and having to learn an instrument
I like to be organized. We like to fill every spot on my calendar, as anybody who has writes to my calendar knows. And I thought, you know, we can't just all of a sudden willy-nilly do this. But they did kind of talk me into it after they had a couple of rehearsals, and I was a little jealous that they were kind of going off and doing this and drinking wine without me.
So
come
it was
on.
FOMO and wine,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah, a little bit of FOMO and wine. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so just getting together. And I think the instruments were taken at that point. So I said I would do the cowbell, the shaker, and anything else that needs to
And
what
did you bring today? You brought the cowbell and
the shaker,
right?
Or
give me a little bit of each.
We got a little cowbell.
Need more cowbell.
Very nice.
That's
and
right.
And
a shaker.
Shaker.
There you go.
Yep.
Although, actually, those are pretty fundamental responsibilities, because if you get off rhythm, you mess everybody
That's right.
up.
That's right.
So are you good at carrying a beat?
It's a lot of stress. I mean, our key player, Martha, the drummer, she really just took it up last year. right? Mm-hmm. She didn't have any experience with
it. Had always wanted to. I mean, again, sort of since college, had gone, checked out bands, thought it would be really cool to be a drummer, loved that Wilco song about being in love with the drummer. And so this was just her opportunity. And my husband has a drum set. And so she just kind of went down. He said, here's some sticks, go for it. And then he kind of browbeat her into practicing. And she's awesome.
So did you ever have a moment where you're in your kitchen and all of a sudden you realize that without you even knowing, Martha's in your basement playing the drums
to
practice?
It's happened from time to time.
Yeah, we kind of just walk in. We kind of just walk. Our kids know that, you know, the moms are down in the basement or in the garage practicing.
All right. So now this really is based on a decades-long friendship for the five of you. What is the craziest thing you had been through before you decided to form a rock band and play at a porch fest? Heather.
Wow. I would say I think one of the craziest things was basically helping Layla when she donated her kidney to her dad. And we all chipped in and we all took turns watching her kids when she was going through the surgery.
How far long ago was that, Layla?
Gosh, COVID is kind of like a blip on my radar right now, but I think it was about 5 years ago now, guys. Is that right? I think it was like 4 or 5 years ago.
Maybe a little more. I feel like I mean, then that's what we've done, really. I mean, that was the most extreme version, but anytime anyone's gotten sick, had you know, been waylaid by anything, just needed a hand, needed pickup, needed a backstop, we were there for each other. We live in the same town. We started getting together when our kids were babies, when our oldest. They're now in college. You know, I don't have family in town. You don't, Layla. So our kids are kind of surrogate family. They went for a few years telling everyone in middle school they were cousins. They don't look alike at all.
I mean, they call the adults aunties and uncles, and we all treat each other as family. And I think that's the key thing, raising our tribe together. It's the only way we could do it. It's the only way. It's the only way we could be successful, I think.
Did it make it easier to make music together?
Yeah, I think so. Because there was no one had to apologize. Everyone was completely supportive. Everyone knew what stage we were in. It was like, just first of all, just do it. Don't worry about making mistakes. We're just going to go and we're going to make it happen. Second of all, you want to sing something, you go for it. Like, we were going to support anything that anyone wanted to bring to a set. It was like, we're gonna just do what everyone wants to do.
And the writing of the songs, yep.
All right, so you didn't start with original songs. You started with covers, and I've got a sound here. This is the 1981 hit, We Got the Beats, the Go-Go's. It's the song, right? This is Milton Porch Fest 2021. Now, our listeners can't see your smiling, beaming faces, but you're so proud of yourselves for having done that, and you're cracking yourselves up. So you've gotten a little more serious since then. You've got original music, which we'll play later, but are you still cracking yourselves up all the time?
Yeah.
All the time. Yes.
I think some of the words that we come up with for the songs are kind of funny. I mean, they're all very heartfelt, and they have something to do with what we're going through in our lives, but it allows us to have a little levity in it all, and I think that's what's key.
Give me an example of a silly or a wild
song we're
lyric.
Singing today.
Debbie's
Ashes.
Yeah,
it's a bit of a tribute to my husband's cousin Debbie, but also it's more a song about reliving childhood and, you know, the things you remember, the games you remember playing as a kid.
So we're speaking with Heather Shaw, Layla Mitchell, and Joanna Weiss. They are three of the five women that make up the Lazy Susans, who have found themselves to be kind of a phenomenon after having decided during COVID to, hey, let's make a band. And you made a band. You set a deadline, Joanna, which was Porch Fest 2021, because you figured if we have to show up somewhere, then we'll do it. Right?
Exactly.
Typical mom.
You put it on the calendar, it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so you showed up with how many songs ready in your little portfolio at
that time? We had 7 songs. They were all covers, and they were kind of an eclectic mix. We had a couple country songs in there. We had a Chick song. We had a White Stripe song. We had an Ingrid Michaelson song that we tried to punk up a little bit. And then we had a couple 80s staples, Pat Benatar and the Go-Go's. And we just got up on that porch, and we were terrified. I mean,
very scary.
It was just like we'd never done anything like this before in front of people. We'd spoken in front of people, but you're exposed in a completely different way when you're singing and you're playing. But it was just, it was exhilarating. It was crazy fun.
So here's you guys again at Porch Fest.
We are the Lazy Susans!
Okay, so explain this to me, because I have been to a number of porch fests, and that is not usually what it sounds like when you usually have like four people going, right? Yeah, so how did you get a teeming horde screaming lazy, lazy, lazy in your first performance?
Well, I think it was MEA's husband.
It was MEA's husband, yeah, who got everybody going. And then all the husbands started shining
in. So just to remind everybody, MEA Zerinolu, who's keys, bass, and vocals. Mm-hmm. And they went out and told everybody, come on down here, come to the porch.
I think the word spread. You know, this was the first porch fest after pandemic. So a lot of people were out. It was a beautiful day. And it was really the first time a lot of people in the neighborhood had seen each other. So people were in a great mood. The vibe was good. I think a lot of people had heard that, you know, this curiosity, like, oh, yes, these moms have a band. So we didn't expect a whole lot of people, because we've been to Porch Fest too, where it was kind of quiet. So we're looking out on the porch and the crowd just starts growing. And
it was terrifying. Like, I looked out and I'm like, there's about 300 people here.
That's huge. So is Porch Fest in Milton, is it spring, summer, or fall?
September, fall.
So this is September of 2021, mm-hmm, right? Okay, because I want listeners to understand this. So this is September of 2021. And then we fast forward to May of 2022, which is not that long, by the way. And here, let's just listen.
These women prove it's never too late to try something new. So please welcome the Lazy Susans, Angela, Joanna, Layla, and Heather. Thank y'all for coming.
Okay, that's Kelly Clarkson, right? So you wind up, what, 6-7 months later, you go out to California, you're on the Kelly Clarkson show, who's a singer, not for nothing. So right. Is that intimidating?
100%.
Yeah.
100%. I mean, it's almost like we always feel like we're living someone else's lives and looking into it. But yeah, that was actually taped in March. So it was a really fast forward. It was kind of like, we started getting these emails and calls and yeah, that was during practice we got
We were
that.
Rehearsing one night in my basement, and I shouldn't have even been checking my phone. Why was I looking at my phone? But I look, and there's an email from a producer at the Kelly Clarkson show. They had seen an article that I had written about us in Boston Magazine, and they were kind of Googling around for, I think, mom content for Mother's Day week and came across us. And I think I said something profane that you can't say on the radio. and then we sent her a selfie, and a half hour later, we were on a Zoom call with the producers.
Yeah.
Was there ever a moment, Heather, where you thought, I'm not sure I want to do this? I don't want to start to kind of hit it?
I was all in. It was funny because when we were meeting with the producer, she's like, okay, so if we were to do this, if you make it on the show, we'll need to tape you next Wednesday. So you're going to need to fly out Tuesday. Now, keep in mind, this was Thursday night. All of my friends pull out their phones like, well, I got soccer practice this night and I've got, you know, taekwondo this night. And I'm like, what is wrong with you all? I'm like, the answer is yes, and we'll figure it out.
And again, we're speaking with Joanna Weiss, Layla Mitchell, and Heather Shaw, three of the five members of the Lazy Susans, which is a local mom band made big over the last couple of years. People knock themselves out to try to make it in the music industry. I mean, Joanna, your husband was a musician, still plays some. I mean, people spend lifetimes of insane levels of talent trying to do this and don't, right? And then the five of you are like, hey, let's play Porch Fest. And the next thing you know, LA calls, and now you've got releases and you're playing gigs. And do you ever feel, does it feel capricious? Like, why you? And what about all those people are going to knock themselves out for 30 years and never make it, Layla?
And they still do. And I think we've struggled with it. We obviously have people in our family. Heather's husband's also in a band. And we have people in our family that have done that. We have good friends that are still doing that. And I think what I'm always saying to the ladies is we have to kind of say we are on our own path. It's a different path. The path that we're taking is, I think people are connecting to the story. We are developing our talent, but by no means have we gone through those struggles and on that other path. So I think what we need to do is kind of own our story. Just keep doing what we set out to do, which was have fun. If we're able to tell a little piece of what we've been doing and inspire others to pick up an instrument, to sing out in front of a crowd, to pick up a hobby they have lost and pick up that passion, I think that's really what our path and our story is taking us.
So we were really touched in the portion of your interview with Kelly Clarkson where, without you guys knowing, they had gone to your kids to ask your kids how they feel about you doing this. Here's a little bit of that.
Honestly, I am so proud of my mom and all the other mothers.
We are super proud of our mom and all the other moms to come together and start a band. Their dedication is incredibly impressive.
I'm really, you know, proud and surprised how far they've come.
I'm just so proud of my mom, and I really look up to her for everything she's done.
I hope that you know that we're with you every step of the way, and all the hard work you put in doesn't go unnoticed.
I know I don't say this enough, but I wanted to know how lucky we were to have her as a mom.
We love you, Mom. Rock on.
Rock on.
Rock on.
Rock on.
We love you, Mom. Rock on.
I'm getting a little teary-eyed.
I know.
I'm getting a little teary-eyed.
What do they know is possible now that they didn't before you guys set the example by doing this?
I mean, I think they just see somebody wanting to do something and doing it, not letting anything stop them. I mean, I think the lesson to me, kind of like Layla was saying, is you don't need to ask anyone else's permission to do something that you've always wanted to do. And the only person who can give you permission is yourself. So if you want to do something, you just get out there and you do it.
Permission to learn something new later in your life, you know, like your learning doesn't stop when you're done with high school or done with college or any point.
Yeah, I think so many of our kids sort of see a stopping point as an adulthood of, oh, that's just a whole nother part of life that you no longer own anymore. You no longer have fun. Mm. You just kind of go to work or you take your kids to soccer or that's what you do. And hopefully, if anything we've taught any of the kids is you can keep having fun. You can keep doing the things that you love. You can be goofy and sing in front of a mirror or sing in front of a whole audience and still love it.
So the one other question that I want to ask, so Joanna, so now you write a Cognoscenti piece, right? And I've read you on Cognoscenti for years, and you've written about all kinds of things. But for this 10th anniversary, rather than all the other kinds of things that, I mean, I used to turn to you for debate debriefs, like 5 seconds after the debate was over, but you choose the Lazy Susans. That must mean that there is something really special in your heart here.
I mean, there's something just very meaningful and kind of profound when you think about it, about this experience. Again, it came out of the pandemic, but it didn't have to. But it just was this kind of moment that made us connect to something in ourselves that we hadn't really connected with before or hadn't in a long time, you know, or like reconnect with something. You know, it's been a way to reconnect with our families. It's been a way to reconnect with our kids. It's been a different way to connect with each other. It's been a creative outlet that we didn't have before that I've written for my entire career. I'd never thought I could write a song. So there's just something really special about this experience, and that's why we don't want it to end.
So do you want to do some singing?
We can give it a
shot. We hope so.
So you brought Debbie's Ashes, which, Heather, you've already told us a little bit about. This is one of how many now original songs you guys have in your portfolio?
Eight.
We have eight originals. This is the unplugged version.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Belle of the bar, packed in a jar.
That was Layla Mitchell, Heather Shaw, and Joanna Weiss, 3/5 of the Milton-based mom rock band The Lazy Susans. And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Sydney Bowles, with Bart Tachi and Andrea Perdomo-Hernandez. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director, Titus Faladun, our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again Monday for a new year and more Radio Boston. Debbie went to heaven.